With Parshas Mishpatim, as happens every year, the Torah gets down to business. And we're introduced to the realm of mitzvahs known as Mishpatim. And I'd like to make mention, by way of introduction, to the world of Mishpatim, to a statement which is made by the Gemara in Masechet Shabbos on Daf Yud, regarding the importance and significance of the realm known as Din, of ensuring that the world is a just place. Interestingly, the Gemara comments on a phrase that's used with reference to Moshe Rabbeinu in last week's parsha, where it says that Moshe was judging and the people were standing by Moshe min haboker ad ha'erev, from morning till evening. And the Gemara takes a special note of that expression, min haboker ad ha'erev. Of course, it gives an association which Chazal recognize and state that this actually relates to the creation of the world itself, the trademark phrase for which was Vayere Vayivoke, Yom Sheni, Yom Shlishi. To the extent that the Gemara states, Kol Hadan Din Emes La Mito, anyone who judges a true judgment, Nasa Shutuf La Kodesh Baruch Hu B'Masa Bereishis. He's considered to be a partner to Hashem in the creation. And the idea, of course, it exists on many levels, but even on the simplest level, he is basically allowing for the ongoing, meaningful and ordered existence of the world that was brought into existence by Hashem. So he is taking the world and promoting it and allowing for its well-being. An interesting aspect of this statement is the phrase din emes la'amito, which Chazal, and it becomes a catchphrase. People say, emes lamito. And of course the question is, what is the meaning of emes lamito? Translated literally, truth for its truth. But presumably every truth is for its truth, because if it's not for its truth, then it's not true. So, as if to say, one should suffice. If you need two, then what's missing in the first one? What is the meaning of emes lamito? And this is a question which is discussed by the Vilna Gaon in his Perush to Mishlei in Perek Kaf Beis. And he directs our attention actually to a pasuk in Parshas Re'eh, where again, if we follow the phraseology, we see that there seems to be a kind of two dynamics going on within every din. The context is the Ir Hanidachas, which is one of the mitzvahs in Parshas Re'eh. And the pasuk reads, so you hear about it, you hear this report about this city, v'dorashta v'chokarta, or more correctly, v'dorashta v'chokarta. You inquire, and you investigate, and find it to be true. V'hine emes nachon hadavar, indeed it is so, that there is such a thing, and then you need to know how to deal with it. In this pasuk, therefore, as well, we find this double over of expression, whereby you have v'dorashta v'chokarta. You inquire and you investigate. What are you inquiring and what are you investigating? Seemingly, or presumably, the same thing. And moreover, as the pasuk continues, the result also seems to have two aspects to it. V'hine emes nachon hadavar. True and correct. What is true and what's correct? Once again, everything that's true, presumably, is correct, and vice versa. And thus, we have emes lamito, we have darashta v'chakarta, we have emes nochon, and we're not sure exactly why they always come in pairs. And in true style, the Vilna Gaon answers all of this by posing another question. One of the well-known mitzvahs that relate to the realms of din is the prohibition against taking a shochad, a bribe. As we know, even the wisest of people, as soon as there's a bribe in the mix, their judgment is skewed. It's the way of the world. And in fact, it's a good thing. As if to say, it's correct that their judgment should be skewed, should be affected, because you should be affected if someone does something good for you. You just can't judge them, that's all. We should not have the misconception that the ideal would be to receive a bribe and for your judgment to be not affected at all. That's not even a mensch. How can your judgment not be affected? Someone did a favor for you. It should be affected. But you just can't sit on the case. That's all. And the prohibition against taking a bribe itself is mentioned twice in the Torah. Once in Mishpatim, our parsha, and the second time in Parsha Shoftim, where many additional aspects and some elaborations also take place. And both psukim talk about the blinding effect of shochad, but somewhat differently. In our parsha, the Torah states that shochad ye'aver pikchim, ye'aver from the word iver, blind, can blind even people that are astute, pikchim. In Parsha Shoftim, it states ye'aver shochad ye'aver einei chachomim, can blind the eyes of the wise. And once again, here we see that in one context, the blinding effect of shochad is expressed as it relates to pikchim, those that are astute, and the other with regards to chachamim, those who are wise. And the Vilna Gaon says that indeed, in order for a dayan to successfully judge a case, he needs to have two qualities. And one is called chachma, and one is called pikchus. Chachma, wisdom, pikchus, he needs to be savvy. In the sense that every din Torah has its halachas. But every din Torah also has its participants. It has its protagonists. It has its litigants. And they're people. Which means that you need to know the halacha well, fluently. But you also need to know people. Because if you have someone who is not in any way astute, it may not occur to him that perhaps there's something about those who are giving testimony that is amiss. Or a little bit awry. Somehow not fully put together. And therefore, if he's a tamim and he judges the case, he accepts their testimony and their words without questioning further, he may have gotten the halacha right, but he's got the whole thing wrong because he's judged the case, but it was wrong for him to accept their testimony. He should have seen. And this can be in any number of ways. Ironically, according to the Gaon elsewhere, sometimes something that should tip the dayan off is if the testimony is perhaps too closely aligned. As if to say, it almost sounds as if they're reading from the same script. Formally, well, it couldn't be better. They are saying exactly the same thing. Says the Vilna Gaon, that's a problem. Doesn't it sound somehow rehearsed? Doesn't it sound perhaps fabricated in some way? One should maybe try and catch one of them out on something where it will emerge that one of them didn't see everything. And he got the details filled in by his chaver. These, then, are the two realms of chochmah and of pikchus. And it's very interesting. Sometimes it's the pikchus that chaps the case. I'm mindful of an episode which I heard from my father's atzal. I believe that it involved Rav Meir Simcha himself, the Meshe Chochmah. He was not the dayan, but he solved the case through his knowledge of people, not so much knowledge of the halacha or the facts. There was an episode where there was this young girl who worked in the village there, and she became pregnant, and she accused some young Jewish man of having attacked her, and it was just a terrible situation. This hapless young individual, what's he going to do? He denies it doesn't make a difference, and the case is looming. And he comes to Rav Meir Simcha distraught and says, well, what can I do? I mean, the case is against me. There's nothing I can do in my defense. And Rav Meir Simcha heard all of the details and he found out where she worked, etc. And he advised this young man, when the time comes and they accuse you of having been you're the father, admit it. Own up to it and say you'll accept whatever punishment is due to you, but you do insist that you take custody of the child and you'll bring him up in Jewish tradition because he's your child. So this young man was even more distraught than ever. I mean, he was looking for a defense and now he's going to have some child to be with him for the rest of his miserable life. but the Rebbe said, so the case comes and everyone's there and it was all eyes were on this case. And they say, what do you have to say in your defense? And he says, I plead guilty. The Rebbe said, the Meir Simcha said, I plead guilty. I accept the accusation, and I wish for the child to be brought up as a Jew, seeing as he's my child. At that point, this young girl who was pregnant, she stood up, she crossed herself, and said in front of everyone, God forbid that the child of a Catholic priest should be brought up as a Jew. Rebbe Simcha understood what was going on. And that's called Pikhim, even before we get to Chachamim. And there are many, many cases or instances where it's really Pikhus that wins the day. But ultimately, one needs both. As the Chazon Ish once said, knowledge of Shulchan Aruch is one thing, but knowledge of which Se'if of Shulchan Aruch to apply to this particular case is an altogether different talent, and that's called Pikhus. And therefore, says the Vilna Gaon, that's what's behind the duality within every investigation. The Torah says, v'darashta, v'chakarta, meaning look into it and you should know the halachas, but v'chakarta, but investigate and inquire and ask questions from the people involved. Because only if you do both will you find that if it is true, it is MS and also nochon, meaning it's actually true and you know what to do about it. I mean, those are the two. And therefore, says the Gaon, all of this is contained within that very ringy phrase of Koladan din emes la'amito, true in its truth, as if to say it's the right psak, but it's also for the right situation. The situation is correct, and then the psak is correct. The person who does that, indeed, is a shutuf la'kodesh baruch hu b'maiseh bereishis. So this is by way of introduction into the hallowed world of Mishpatim, and it's next to Sinai. Because the Mishpatim of the Torah are next to Sinai. And I'd like to discuss for a moment something which is at the heartland of Mishpatim, the world of Nezikin, which is of damages, and a specific type of damage which is very much of practical import. We're familiar with the concept of Tam and Muad, the two famous oxen. If for the first three times, we assume he's not really violent, and it was just a freak occurrence, and he only pays half damages. That's called a tam. That's called short tam. Muad is already forewarned, and you know, and he has a violent past, and he's a violent animal, and you have to take the necessary precautions. And if you don't, so then the liability is for full damages. That's tam and muad. That is with regards to animals. But the Mishnah, in the end of the second perek of Maseches Bava Kamma, informs us that the institutions, or the categorizations, more correctly, of tam and muad apply to animals, but they do not apply to people. There is no first three times, wasn't really sure whether he should be liable when it comes to people. Not at all. In the words of the Mishnah, this is on the Gemara's Kaf Vav Amud Aleph, Adam muad la'olam, a person, always muad, from day one, from the beginning, from the outset. And what this means is, ben shogeg, ben mezid. It's not only that he is liable fully from the outset. The scope of his liability is way beyond what you find with his property, for example. And what that means is, as the Mishnah outlines, ben shogeg, ben mezid, whether he damages intentionally or unintentionally. Ben er, ben yoshein, whether he damages awake or even when he's sleeping, he damages in his sleep, he's still liable. Simi es in chaveiro, if he knocks his fellow's eye out, or shiver es akelim, or he breaks his vessels, meshalem nezek shalem, he pays full damages. And it's learned from Sukkim, we're not going to go into the details, but what we do see is that there is a concept which is called Adam Hamazik, a person who does damage with his person. And there are distinctions in his broader property where we might say there's something called onus, force majeure, it's beyond his control, and therefore, and the halacha recognizes that. But the concept of onus does not exist with the person himself. Even if he does damage, but onus, as the Gemara expresses it, he's still liable to pay. And that's that. He's asleep, doesn't matter. Didn't mean it, doesn't matter. Didn't see it, doesn't matter. Always liable. That is the chiddush. At the epicenter of Nezikin is the person himself. Always liable. Now, as we know from past experience, it's never fully over until Tosfos have spoken. And Tosfos have a most fascinating thing to say, but they back it up instantly. And that is, says Tosfos, when we say that when it comes to damage that a person does themselves, bodily damage, Adam HaMazik, that they're liable even in a case of onus beyond the control, you should know that there are two types of onus. There's two levels of onus. There's what you could call incomplete onus, not fully beyond his control, onus she'eino gomer. But then there's a type of onus which is fully beyond his control. Onus, gomer, complete onus. And there, Tosfos assert, even a person is exempt for damages done. But the lower onus, liable, and that's a chiddush. Higher onus, even a person is exempt. And I'll prove it to you, say Tosfos. I'll prove it to you from a statement of the Yerushalmi. The Mishnah told us that if a person does damage when he's sleeping, he's still liable to pay. That's black on white in the Mishnah. But the Yerushalmi says that's only true if the person that he damages, or the vessels that he damages, person that he injures, or vessels that he damages, were there when he went to sleep. But if he goes to sleep, and as far as he's concerned, that's it, it's just him. And then someone lies down next to him while he's already sleeping, or puts their things down next to him while he's already sleeping, and then he damages them in his sleep, he's exempt. Say, Tosfos, why? What can you say? It's beyond his control. But didn't we say that he's liable even if it's beyond his control? We see from here, say Tosfos, that even in the world of onus, there's two levels. If there's something there when you go to sleep, you're meant to be somewhat conscious of it. Even when you're sleeping, people maintain an awareness of where they were. It's a lower awareness. Perhaps in other areas he'd be exempt. Here he's liable. But if there's no notion that it's there when he goes to sleep, that's called onus gomer. You see that he's exempt in onus gomer. And the question is, why? As if to say, if we just absorb the idea that you're liable, even if it's beyond your control, what room is there to then start distinguishing partially beyond your control, completely beyond your control? Where does it come from? Onus is onus. Rav Moshe Feinstein discusses this question in his Sefer Dibros Moshe, which is his Perushim on the Masechtas, in volume many times over the Igros Moshe. And Moshe says, you know, if you look back to the Mishnah, and the way the Mishnah phrased the situation with the person himself, the words were, Adam Muad La'olam. Muad La'olam, the word Muad means forewarned. It means you should have known better. You should have been more careful. That is the profile of a person. He's always muad, forewarned. As if to say, do not think, say Tosfos, that the moral of the story is, it's not your fault, but you have to pay anyway. That's not the point. The point is not that we raise the level of liability higher than your culpability. The point is we raise the level of your culpability. Generally speaking, you should be vigilant to a certain degree. With yourself, to a higher degree. You are forewarned to a higher degree. But if that's the way it works, says Moshe, we'll appreciate that if it's really still about vigilance, but just to a higher degree, there's room for completely beyond your control. As if to say, I was vigilant and it didn't help. I was as vigilant as I could be. It still didn't help. That will be recognized because you're mu'ad, but even being mu'ad didn't help. Or perhaps to put it slightly differently, formulaically, if the point of Adam Mu'ad La'olam means for a person themselves, you should be vigilant beyond the norm, there is a level which is called beyond the beyond. And at that point, everyone will exempt you. That is the position of Tosfos, and that's why it makes a difference whether things there when he went to sleep or not. However, the position of Tosfos is disputed by no less than the Ramban. And the Ramban takes a completely contrary position. The Ramban says every single onus a person is liable. As if to say, the Ramban takes the second point of view. No one is saying it's your fault. That's not what's behind this. It's not your fault. But you did it. And therefore you have to pick up the bill. That's what it's about. It's not about raising culpability. Your responsibility is for any act of damage that you did, even if it's complete onus. Well, as we can appreciate, we will have a question for Ramban. Namely, how will you explain the Yerushalmi, which says that if there was nothing there when he went to sleep and then things came there afterwards, he's exempt for breaking them? Tosfos explained it. That's called onus gomer. You don't recognize an exemption of onus gomer. All onus is liable. So why is he exempt in that case? Says Ramban, the reason why he's exempt in that case is because the victim is at fault. Rarely do we say the victim is at fault. But if someone's sleeping, which means they've checked out, belaz, and you put your things next to them, or you put yourself next to them and go to sleep, that is negligence on the victim's part. You cannot have a person who brings the damage on themselves, and the damage itself was completely unknowing, and then claim to be recompensed for that. At this point, all will agree. So it's not so much that we remove the culpability from the damager. That's never the issue. But we actually place an element of culpability on the victim. You cannot bring it on yourself and then pick up the bill after that. Very interesting. As we can appreciate, and we're always looking for what's called nafka mina. Is there a practical difference between Tosas and Ramban? After all, they both agree in form to everything. If the person was asleep, if the things were there before he went to sleep, liable, each one for their reason. If he wasn't there, exempt, each one for their reason. So they happen to agree. It just seems to be a non-practicing machlokas between Tosas and Ramban. But there would be a practical difference between them. Namely, what happens if A goes to sleep and then C puts B's things there? There's always one who will do that. As if to say, it's not the victim who put his things there. It's someone else who put the victim. Now, that someone else will not be indicted because he's a grummer. He's a cause. He doesn't actually do anything. But you can't blame the victim. They say the victim is completely... he doesn't know. He's not there. Someone else put his things there. In this case, there would actually be a different verdict between Tosas and Ramban. Namely, according to Tosas, he will be exempt because we always focus on the one who did damage. And because there was nothing there when he went to sleep, we call that onus gomor. Completely beyond his control, he remains exempt. Doesn't make a difference who put them there. But according to the Ramban, you're always liable in onus, unless the victim brought it on himself. But here it wasn't the victim that brought the damage on himself. It was someone else, and therefore he has no culpability. The one who did the damage will yet have to pay. And as we can appreciate, this is something that, which could also have expression and perhaps more commonly. When it comes to traffic accidents, lo aleinu, if one car breaks suddenly, irresponsibly, although it's always considered to be the fault of the one behind, but let's assume even for argument's sake his brake lights aren't working or whatever it will be. Or if they're cyclists where they don't have brake lights, and we assume that he's at fault, he breaks suddenly, leaving the car behind him, not enough time. That's analogous to the situation. We'll either call that onus gomor, if we will, there just wasn't enough time, or we'll say it's your fault, why did you break suddenly? But doesn't it often happen that actually it's the car in front who brakes irresponsibly, and then the one in the middle, he has no choice but to brake responsibly. He needs to come to a sudden halt so as not to damage the car who is irresponsible. And then he gets knocked by the car behind him. The one in front is oblivious to all of this. He hears noises and sees flashing lights. He has no idea what's going on. But that would be an illustration of our case, where the one who gets damaged, he's not at fault, but the one behind had no time but to stop. Interestingly, the question as to how to relate to onus gomor remains undecided until our time. It remains in flux, which means that we invoke the concept of hamotzi mechavero olaf haraya, that you need to prove that he is liable in the case of onus gomor, if it is a case of onus gomor, in order to make him pay, which we can't do. And there are many such cases. A classic one, which was discussed by the poskim, relates to someone who moved into someone else's apartment. And he noticed a very bad smell coming from the freezer. The freezer had been unplugged, and all the chickens there were. There's a few chickens there that had completely gone off. So he takes them, throws them out. And later, a few days later, when the balabaya comes in, he says, you know, someone turned off your freezer, and there was a terrible smell coming. I threw the chickens out. And the landlord almost hit the roof. It turned out that the landlord, everyone has a place where they hide their money. So I think under the mattress is already oversubscribed. So he used to put it in the chickens, in the freezer. Which means that this person threw out the chickens, he actually threw out a fortune of money, like thousands and thousands of dollars. And once again, here, we would call that onus gomor, in the sense that, and this is very interesting, because it is called an onus. It's not onus in the sense that he was forced. It's not beyond his control. We cannot say he had no choice but to throw them out. It's onus in the sense that you cannot have expected more from him. He acted completely within the realm. If he starts looking into the chicken to see just maybe there's money there, I mean, that's a person who has too much spare time on their hands. And therefore, there's no way that he could reasonably have expected that there would be money there. He throws it out. That would be called onus gomer. And the question then devolves to onus gomer. And the truth is, because it's a suffix, he cannot be made to pay. But these are it could very often happen in different iterations. I think we could perhaps say in that case that he could not be accused of foul play, even though I may add that we are not dealing with a paltry sum of money. Just one final point with regards to Adam HaMazik, and this is truly fascinating, and it's from the great Reb Shlomo Fischer, Shalita of Yerushalayim here. Here we are saying that to whatever degree you subscribe to it, if you're Ramban, every onus. If you're Tosfos, incomplete onus. But to whatever degree, there is a concept where even if the damage was unintentional, you did it, and you have to pay. Adam Mu'ad La'olam. Interestingly, there is another unique set of halachas that applies to a person who Adam HaMazik, who himself does damage. Namely, when a person does damage or injury, more correctly, he needs to pay what's called the five tashlumin. He needs to pay the whole thing. He's got to pay for the person's medical bills. He's got to pay for his unemployment. He's got to pay for the distress caused and even embarrassment caused. All these things. These are the famous five tashlumin. Nezek, tzar, ripui, sheves, and boshes. That's unique to a person who themselves does damage. If his animal embarrassed someone by damaging them, it's not relevant. But the person himself? So these are two chidushim when the person himself does damage. Number one, even if it's unintentional. And number two, he has to pay five tashlumin. But what's interesting is, if he damages unintentionally, the halacha is he doesn't have to pay those five tashlumin. Just the damage. Just the loss incurred. And the question, of course, is decide. That seems to be a contradiction. If this is unique to Adam HaMazik, we know that Adam HaMazik pays five types of things. And that's the whole point here. So why is it that when he damages unintentionally, which is also a chiddush of Adam HaMazik, he just pays one? Says Reb Shlomo Fischer, the chiddush that if a person does damage with their own body, they are liable to pay even if it's unintentional, that is not really Adam HaMazik for a simple reason. Adam, the person, is the person's will. It's the person's intention. That's the Adam. And therefore, if a person does damage with their body unintentionally, it is not fully correct to say the person damaged, because the person was absent. They had no such intention. You can say their body damaged. The chiddush of being liable for onus is to say that a person is responsible for their property generally and for their body to a higher degree. But if they have no intention, it's not called Adam. The five tashlumin is when you do it intentionally, because then the Adam did damage. But if it's unintentional, the Adam's body did damage, and the Adam is liable for damage done by his body. But it's just like his animal, in a sense, but it's the animal closest to home. And this is really a fascinating idea, and you see how it cuts right into the halacha, and it bears out an idea which is echoed by the Maharal in a number of places. For we note that there are two verbs in the Torah for taking. And we find often that, or the word lakach, vayikach, consistently, when the Torah says that a person was taken, like for example, Hashem took Adam and put him into Gan Eden, Avram took Sarai and took her to Eretz Canaan, Rashi always says he convinced him, or he convinced her, lekacha bedvarim. It doesn't just say he took her, or he took him. When it comes to objects, there's nothing to say. You can't convince an object. But when people are taken, Rashi always adds, they were convinced. He encouraged them. And it's borne out, actually, in Unculus. We had a look last week in Unculus. We see how the Mefarshim watched carefully every word from Unculus. He has two different translations. When an object is taken, Unculus translates as nasav, taken. When a person is taken, Unculus translates as dabar, It's a different word. But actually, it relates to the word dibur, from speak, because you can only take a person by speaking to them. But why? Says Maral, because the person is the person's will. That's the Adam. Which means if you take a person against their will, you haven't taken the person because they don't agree with you. Their will does not consent. So you've taken every aspect of the person except the person. And that's why if the Torah says that Hashem took Adam or Avram took Sarai, if you take the whole person, it must be that they come to agree with you. And that can only be because you encourage them and you persuade them, etc., until their intention is aligned with yours. So we see from the world of Parshanut how it bears out this idea, the Adam within the person. And as it expresses itself ultimately, even in the most basic halachas of Nezikin. So that's with regards to Adam HaMazik, of course, plenty to say. All of Bava Kamma and most of Bava Metzia is in Parshas Mishpatim, but we'll content ourselves with this for the time being. Interestingly, a mitzvah, moving on for a few moments, which makes its first appearance in Parshas Mishpatim, is Basar B'Chalav, is meat and milk. And that is to be found in Perek Kav Gimel, Pasuk Yud Tes. Mishpatim begins with Mishpatim, but at a certain point it branches out in the later sections. And the pasuk states, well-known pasuk, Reishis b'kurei ad mascha tavi beis Hashem elokecha. You should bring b'kurim, the first of your fruits, to beis Hashem. Lo sevash el gadi b'chalev yimo, not to cook a kid in its mother's milk. Now, there's of course a number of things to say about this pasuk lo sevash el gadi b'chalev yimo. Firstly, as much as the Torah speaks in a very specific instance of a young animal in the milk specifically of its mother, as we know, and this is learned out from Medrash Halacha, that in fact it's not restricted to that case, of course. It's any animal in any milk. It doesn't have to be the milk of the mother per se. Interestingly, though, also, the Torah does mention this three times. Firstly in Mishpatim, next in Kisisa, in just a two or three weeks' time, and then finally in Chumash Devarim, in Parshas Re'eh. And the halacha is cognizant and recognizes all of these three cases and understands that it progressively is looking to limit the scope. That is to say, every time it emphasizes gedi, which is a young animal, it means not fowl, I mean not poultry, and not even chaya, which is an undomesticated animal. On a Torah level, those things, there is no prohibition. It's only what's called a behema, a domesticated animal. Okay. And therefore, it turns out, we already have said enough to summarize. Because with these words, lo sevashel gadi b'chalev imo, not to cook a kid in his mother's milk, you have the literal translation, which is a kid in its actual mother's milk. You have the halacha, which is any animal in the milk of any animal. And then you have the repetition, which gives you the progressive exclusion of oaf and then chaya, so that it just refers to a behema itself. Now, that is the situation, and it's also of note that all these three prohibitions, and there are three separate prohibitions, cooking, of eating, and of benefiting. Basar b'chalav is forbidden for benefit if it's min haTorah, but the Torah prohibition is only when the basar b'chalav are cooked together. That's the d'oraisa situation. It's asur even to cook, even without eating. Lo sevashel, kipshuta. And once it's cooked, it's also on a Torah level also to eat and to have benefit from. But as we know, the Rabbanon have added protective measures here. We do not have meat and milk even if they're not cooked together. And there are many, many minhagim. People wait however long they wait. 3 hours, 6 hours, 1 hour, whatever it may be. And moreover, as much as the pasuk excludes chaya and oaf, undomesticated and fowl, but the halacha includes them. As we know, we don't have chicken with milk, and et cetera, and so forth. And that's a siag. That's a protective measure. And that's the job of the Rabbanon, to protect against a Torah infraction, which is a serious thing. And what's fascinating in this case is that we might not think it's in need of a special treatment or special explanation. Why is it that the rabbis forbade also chaya and oaf, even though they're mutter from the Torah? So the person shouldn't come to misunderstanding, shouldn't come to mishap, as is always the case. The rabbis always broadened the scope. That's the protective fence. Amazingly, though, the Rambam says more. He has a specific explanation as to why the rabbis did this. In Basar B'chata, which is as follows. This is in the Mishnah Torah, Hechos Macholas Asuros, Perek Tes, Halacha Dalet. Basar Chaya V'Oaf, also the flesh of Chaya, undomesticated, and Oaf, fowl. Bein B'chol of Chaya, Bein B'chol of Behema. Asar B'achila Medivrei Sofrim. All of these are forbidden on a Derabbanan level. As we know, that's the halacha. Why? Rambam explains in Mishnah Torah. Kedei shelo yifshehu a'am. So that people shouldn't be negligible or act reprehensibly. The avoli de iser basa b'chalav, shel Torah, that they shouldn't come to actually have basa b'chalav from the Torah. They actually have the flesh of an animal in the milk of an animal. Shahari ein mashma hakosav ela gedi b'chalev imo mamash. Because don't forget, says the Rambam, the simple implication of the words, or connotation of the words, or translation of the words, is the animal in its own mother's milk. I mean, that's what the words seem to say. That's why the rabbis vetoed all basar b'chalav. In other words, what Rambam is saying here is that our situation goes beyond what we would call a normal protective measure. Normally, the Isser and the Torah is quite clear. People can still get mixed up, so the rabbis make a protective measure. Here, the Torah itself, as much as halachically its darshan is referring to any animal with any milk, but the words of the Torah people could make a mistake about that, which could draw them in, and they say, as long as they're not related, it's not the mother, it's okay. And because you have that added concern, I believe this is what the Rambam is saying, because you have the added concern, that's why you have an added layer of protection. As if to say, if the goal is to protect the Torah prohibition is behema, domesticated. How many layers of protection do you need? Just one. So add chaya, undomesticated, and it's protected. But the Rabbanon added oaf as well. Why? Why did they add an extra layer of protection? I think that's what the Rambam is coming to explain, because there's an extra cause for concern. It's not just the quote-unquote general concern of a mix-up, but it's actually people may misconstrue the words of the pasuk itself to say that it's mutter. That the Rabbanon dealt with that by adding. So the irony, one could say, is the Torah repeatedly uses the word gedi in order to exclude chaya and oaf from the repetition. But from a certain point of view, it is the words gedi b'chalevimo themselves that were the impetus for the Rabbanon to include them back into the prohibition in order to protect against a misunderstanding. And that's the unique situation of basar b'chalav as we have at Lahalacha. The question is, if we may ask, what's it all about? As if to say, why? Why did the Torah forbid basar b'chalav? So I will not start with the earliest person to speak about it. I'll start with the most direct answer, which is in Rabbeinu Bachya. Rabbeinu Bachya, he quotes other explanations, and he does not accept them. Rabbeinu Bachya insists on classifying basar b'chalav in the area of mitzvahs known as chukim. We don't know. There are many different types of things that the Torah insists should remain distinct from each other. Some of them we know very well. Shatnas, wool and linen, and kilayim, certain mixtures as they're grown. And in this respect, says the Rabbeinu Bachya, it's another type of forbidden mixture. Wool and linen are both permitted, but they can't be mixed. Grain and wine and grapes are both permitted, but they can't be mixed. Meat and milk are both kosher to mahadrin, but they can't be mixed. It's the same type of thing, and we don't know why. It's in the way that the world is wired that relates back to the realm called chukim, and that's it. However, Rambam, and Rabbeinu Bachya is well aware of the Rambam, he quotes the Rambam, but for our purposes, moving on to the Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim in Chelek Gimel, and Chelek Gimel of Mor Nevuchim is where the Rambam provides reasons for mitzvahs, and in Perek Memches, Rambam suggests a reason. And I say suggests a reason because he himself states that he has no evidence for it, but he still thinks that it's true. And that is, says Rambam, it appears to me that at the heart of the Torah vetoing all basar b'chalav is the notion that it was an idolatrous practice to do this, right? To cook a kid in its mother's milk. And therefore, the roots of this prohibition are actually more in Avodah Zarah or in Chukas HaGoy than they are in what we would call the general quote-unquote kashrus. Practically speaking, we put all kashrus together because if it's osur to eat, it's osur to eat. We don't have a separate section for Avodah Zarah generated things that you can't eat. It's all called treif, or we call not kosher. But in pure terms, says Rambam, it seems to me, and the reason why he says this, or among the reasons, is because we see that basar b'chalav, it features within the context of shalosh regalim, of aliyah l'regel, in this week's parsha, and in kisisa, shalosh pamim bashana, yerek ha-zachurcha, it's about coming to the Beis HaMikdash, and the draw of the Beis HaMikdash for Rambam significantly in his approach was to draw people away from anything that's reprehensible in the world of korbanos. Do it right, don't do it wrong. And within that context, the final word is always which sounds like that's another thing that the Torah wants you not to do wrong within the context of korbanos and avoda. Interestingly, says Rambam, so I think it's avoda zara, but I can't prove it. And what he means by that is the Rambam had access to many descriptions of Avodah Zarah, and he refers to them where necessary. There's the Book of the Tzaba and others. And here says Rambam, I didn't find it there. So I've never seen anyone describe it as Avodah Zarah, but I think it is. So that's what I think. What's very interesting is, pointed out by Rav Kasher, that's all, in the end notes to the Torah Shleima, that the Rambam's, in this respect, the Rambam was borne out and verified his word, his approach. He refers to excavations that took place in Syria, and they unearthed this tablet, which has a description of some rite, and ended up being that they cooked the kid in the mother's milk. So the Rambam was mechaven, even though he didn't actually see it. And the point is, says Rambam, you see where basar b'chalav is? This is a parshanut question. See where the Torah talks about it, and see where the Torah doesn't talk about it. As if to say, there's an entire section of Torah that deals with kashrus. It's in Chumash Vayikra. It's in Parsha Shmini. And there you've got the whole thing. Split hooves, choose the cud, fins and scales, the whole thing. So if this is another quote-unquote kashrus issue, it should be in Parsha Shmini. It's not even in the same Chumash. It precedes them. And it's always put within the context of Shalosh Regalim. And that is why I say, as Rambam did, it's not about a pure, so to speak, kashrus issue, but rather it's something that the Torah assered as generated by this Avodah Zarah or Chukas HaGoy concern. Now, there is a follow-up point here, which is quite fascinating. And that is all of the macholas asurim, what we call the forbidden foods. They're one of the things that the Torah goes over again in Chumash Devarim, in Parshas Re'eh. You'll get it all again. You'll get the pig and the camel and the split hooves and the fins and scales. You get there. Interestingly, it all comes together, as if to say, in Parshas Re'eh, in Perek Yudalit. So you have the whole presentation again of the kosher species, non-kosher species of every kind. And then at the end, in Pasuk Kaf Aleph, the Tochlu Kol Nevela, not either car or meat that has not been shechted properly. Give it off to a sojourner or sell it off to a non-Jew. The third and final time of basar b'chalav It does come together, interestingly. Now, one could say perhaps balabatishly that for purposes of the Torah's going over everything, it no longer preserves the distinction in terms of, but does this come from really from Trefus, or does it come from Avodah Zarah? It puts them all together because it's reviewing in brief, so to speak, and therefore they all come together. But what's fascinating is, as much as the Torah has put them together, they're still not completely together. They're in the same group, and Basar B'Chalav is still distinct. Not just because it's lost. I mean, something has to be lost. Not just because it's lost. But if you look at the Pasuk again, it's been through all of the kosher species, non-kosher species, and then Letoch L'Kol Nevela, etc. Final words are, Ki Am Kadosh Ata L'Hashem L'Kecha, for you are a holy nation to Hashem. And then, L'Savasha Gadi B'Chalev Yimah. What's interesting about this situation? The words Ki Am Kadosh Ata L'Hashem L'Kecha are words of summation. They are words of conclusion. As if to say, all of the above, what's it all about? Ki Am Kadosh Ata L'Hashem L'Kecha. And therefore, there is room to say, and Mefarshim raised this question, why is it that we have these words of summation before we've even finished talking? The Parsha concludes, but it hasn't even mentioned everything on the list yet. Because it says, don't eat such and such and such and such and such, because I'm Kadosh. Oh, and also don't eat Basar B'Chalav. That's really the atmosphere of this Pasuk. Why? And here, and this is pointed out by Rav Kuperman Zatzal in his Sefer Pshuta Shamikra, you see that even as, shall we say, geographically, Basar B'Chalav has come much, much closer, but there's still a mechitza, right? There's still something between them, because it's in the same parsha, but it's not part of the same group. And how is that expressed? The list ends, and then we find, it's almost like a new list. It's there, but there's only one thing on the list. And that's how the Torah, on the one hand, brings them together, but nonetheless tells us, but there's something about Basar B'Chalav, as was always true, remains true, not exactly the same. It's very interesting, and Rav Kuperman suggests that there's something about Basar B'Chalav, but people are so sensitive to it. It's almost like, you know, the Jewish people, they wait, and etc. and so forth, and maybe there's a kind of like a whiff of the distancing from the roots of what Basar B'Chalav is about, almost beyond the other trefers, because it's rooted in Avodah Zarah itself, according to Rambam. The final explanation that I'd like to present for Basar B'Chalav, and it's the most unusual statement, especially in terms of who it comes from, if one may say, and that is from the Ralbag. The Ralbag, Rabbeinu Levi ben Gershon, one of the great Rishonim, he has a perush on the Torah, and he has his own, it's a whole enterprise. Rabag is its own study. Rabag points out that if we're paying attention to the context of Basar B'Chalav, we should note not only does it appear consistently with regards to Shalosh Regalim, but even more immediately it appears with regards to Bikurim. Again, in our Parsha and Kisisot, the first two of the three mentionings, the Pasuk has both of them in it. It always starts with Bikurim. Reshis ko Bikuriyat Maschot Tavi Beis Hashem Elokech, bring Bikurim, and then Lo Savasha Gadi B'Chalev Imah. Which means if the Rambam, so to speak, set the scene by saying that generally Basar B'Chalav features within Shalosh Regalim and Beis HaMikdash, but specifically it features with reference to Bikurim. But what's the connection between Bikurim and Basar B'Chalav? They seem to be the most unlikely partners in anything. But the Torah always puts them together. And Ralbag has an approach which is quite unique. What is Bikurim about? Bikurim is about the way a person is meant to look at the world. When the new fruits come in, it's new, it's a beginning. And that should really bring a person towards an appreciation of where all these beginnings come from. Parashas Bara Elokim. And that's where you bring Bikurim to the base of Mikdash. It's a recognition of where the world comes from and where the yearly cycle comes from. That's the goal of Bikurim. However, there's always the danger, and there's always the possibility that we'll just miss the point. As if to say, you see the fruit, and where does it come from? From the tree. And where does the tree come from? From another fruit. And it just goes round and round. In other words, it's possible to have food for such a productive awareness and to use that very thing that a person is contemplating to avoid it. As if to say, when I look at the fruit, I think nature just goes round and round. And that takes what should have been a productive experience to become a destructive one. And that, says the Rabag, is the idea that is contained within, again, the literal meaning, imagine, what's a mother's milk for? A mother's milk is meant to give life to its young. And here, there's something about to use that milk to cook the dead young. It's like a violation. Something that should have been a life-promoting experience becomes just the end. And it leads nowhere, and it's just to its demise. And says Rabak, that's what happens if a person doesn't bring Bikurim. That's the connection between them. Bikurim is about making sure that you take notice of all the things that one should notice in life, that they should be life-promoting. Don't cook a kid in its mother's milk, as if to say, don't take Bikurim and just say, oh, that's just the way the world is, and the whole thing becomes a waste. The very spectacle that should have brought a person to an awareness just leads to put them further in denial. That is called cooking a kid in its mother's milk. It's an amazing explanation of the Rabag from the Rishon. So we've worked hard this evening with the Zikin and Basar B'Chalav. I'd just like to conclude with the most important comment from the Ksav HaKabbalah, and it relates to the penultimate pasuk of the parsha. In Perek Kaf Dalet of Shmos, it goes back to Har Sinai. That's a well-known question, as we know. Was it subsequent to Mishpatim? Was it before even Matan Torah? That's Rashi and Ramban. But in any event, it does describe Matan Torah, aspects of Matan Torah. And the pasuk reads, Perek Kaf Dalet, pasuk Yud Zayin. Umarek Vod Hashem, the vision of the glory of Hashem, ke'esho cheles berosh ha'har, was like a consuming fire at the top of the mountain, le'enei b'nei Yisrael, in the vision of b'nei Yisrael. So that's it. What did the glory of Hashem look like? It looked like a consuming fire. The Ksav HaKabbalah, Rabbi Yaakov Tzvi Mecklenburg, asked two questions, and they're quite different from each other. One is very machshavadik, and one is very dictavdik. First, he says, Ksav HaKabbalah, I'm not sure what I meant to get from this pasuk, which tells me what the vision of the glory of Hashem, because we know that the glory of Hashem itself is not something that can be seen. So to start describing it like a fire, how is that meant to help me? That's number one. Number two, says Ksav HaKabbalah, why does the pasuk refer to the fire as Esh Ocheles, which literally means consuming fire, when as far as we're concerned, there is no other kind? I mean, that goes with the territory. Fire consumes. So every fire is a consuming fire. So if it said ka'esh, I wouldn't have been in doubt. Does it mean a consuming fire, a non-consuming fire? Every fire is a consuming fire. And that's why the Ksav HaKabbalah says that this pasuk is not a description of what it looked like, of what that time was like. It's an evaluation of its effect on the Jewish people. Because here is the Jewish people, and when we picture them, and we say we receive Torah, the Jewish people is made up of Jewish people, and there are a lot of them. And when they receive the Torah, we may be inclined to say, well, to what degree did they receive the Torah? Did they all receive the Torah to the same degree, if one can ask? And the answer is, probably not, for the simple reason that time has been given to prepare to receive Torah. First the 7 weeks, and then at the end there's 3 days. Those are days of preparation. Preparation is there for a reason. It breeds a certain result. It allows the person to be prepared. Receiving Torah is a function of the preparedness of the person to receive. To say that everyone received Torah to the same degree means that they all prepared to the same degree, and that is very unlikely because there are hundreds of thousands of them. Rather, what happened was is that the more one prepared, the more one received. The very same experience was received to a greater or lesser degree, dependent only on the receiver, because the experience itself was the giver is constant. And that's what the Pasuk is communicating, says Aksaba Kabbalah. You see, it's when it says it's Ke'esh Ocheles, it's like the way fire consumes. And how does fire consume? Well, what does it depend on? It depends on what it's exposed to. There are some materials which are highly combustible. And there are other materials which are marginally combustible. And there are others which are basically fire resistant. The fire is the same, but it's about the property of that which it's exposed to that determines as to the effect, whether it takes fire. And that's really what the Pasuk is saying. Mare kavod Hashem, it was there. And what was it like? You know what it was like? It's ke'esh ocheles. It's like the way fire consumes. The more combustible people made themselves, the more they lent themselves to be affected by it, the more they received. Less so, less so. That was true at Har Sinai and remains true as we have the ongoing Matan Torah. The Torah is there projecting the whole time. How much do we receive? It's ke'esh ocheles. The more combustible we make ourselves, the more the Torah sets us alight. That's a function of our preparedness, and that's certainly also food for thought. We'll leave it over there.